being a father. And as I say, about those who haven't got a wife at this point of time, you may have one soon, and then of course the chances are probably pretty high that you're going to be a father. So if you're not one yet, please listen in. If you're a grandfather or a great-grandfather here today, you've got something on me. You should be up here. And when I saw all these wise and sagely older men come here this afternoon, I thought there are some places in this whole topic where I'm out of my depth. And if I find myself getting out of my depth tonight, I'll have to call upon some of those older and wiser men. Ronald Conway, a Melbourne psychologist, has a chapter in his book on Australian life with the title The Vanishing Father. I think it's chapter 2, if I remember, of that particular book, and it certainly does make disturbing reading. Ronald Conway is a most perceptive sort of character, and his bottom line is that fathering is dying in our land. He's not simply saying that fathers are vanishing into smoke, that they're ticking off, not showing up. Well, of course, that is happening, but he is saying that the whole thing of fatherhood is falling down in Australia, and he gives much evidence to show that. Again, we're going to think of this large subject from the point of view of what it means to be a man. There are some things that only a father can supply to his child, and I list these four things: a father's love, masculine authority, manly example, and godly guidance. And we're going to go quickly through those four things, and I'm sure that in many cases they're going to be a reminder to you of things that you already know. Number one, a father's love. Men should never feel odd or embarrassed about showing love in the home. It's a vital ingredient for happiness and stability. It's strange how that some he-men, you know, they've got hairs on their chest and they've sort of act tough, and maybe they've got men under them at work and all the rest of it, and yet they don't have the courage to say those three words, I love you. Am I right? Yes. It doesn't really come easily to Australian men to show love, to express it, and yet we've got some people around us in our homes that really need it. To his wife, well, I'm sure we did cover that in the last session. Children thrive on seeing parents showing love to each other. Children really do want to know that their parents have got a good thing going. It really is for them so often that we express love in the home to our partners. I remember hearing about a married couple who were standing near the lounge room window. And it was just that time when men come home from work. They happened to look out through the lounge room window and they saw a man come along the footpath and up the path to the house next door, a bunch of flowers in his hand, rang the doorbell. And when his wife, who it was, of course, at the door, came out, she was just so wonderfully surprised, and she threw her arms around him and gave him a kiss. And in this house, the wife said to husband, "Why don't you do that?" Well, he said, "I couldn't do that. I hardly know the woman." Well, some of you can understand that, can't you? It's a good enough argument, isn't it? And then a man should show his love to his infant children. Now, if you read authorities on this subject, they will say that the early years in the life of a child are of vital importance. Now, I think in the past, men have tended to think that babes in arms are really for mums, and, you know, dad just comes along and does coochie-coo and all that sort of thing under the chin, and then he goes away and does his important work. And then, of course, when they're tinies toddling around the place, it's not all that much different. He does enough with them, you know, plays a few games and throws them up to the roof and catches them and that sort of thing, and that's the end of story. But it seems as though modern research is telling us that there's something of tremendous importance in the early development of a child that requires both mother and father. In fact, it's alarming to think of how much actually takes place in the life of a child in the first 12 months. You know, that little baby in the first 12 months of its life is reacting, responding to the atmosphere that's around it and to the moods and to the emotions of the people near to it all the time. It's happening like clockwork. And that's why it's a terribly important period. Of course, others will go back further and they will say that a child can in fact receive vibes of an emotional kind when it's in the womb. And all of this becomes rather scary, doesn't it? It makes us think, well, we ought to act very carefully toward them. I don't know whether any of you read the report in the Advertiser just some weeks ago that talked about violence in Australia and violence in the Australian home. Did you happen to note in that article that the most vulnerable age of any person in Australia to the kind of violence that I'm talking about is in the first 12 months? They are the most vulnerable people to abuse in our land. What a commentary upon the state that we're in Australia. Taking out our anger and whatever else upon helpless little babies. But as I say, the evidence is all coming through to say, fathers, you're needed with infant children. They need your presence, they need the security, or whatever it might be that they gain from you. So we cannot simply overlook the role of the father in the forming of the adult from the child. Now, see to his sons and daughters as they grow. Now, haven't you noticed this? Those of you who are old enough to have children that are either in their teens or have grown out of them and so on, you're looking back upon this time, that they need confirmation of the love of their father. Now, so often that is lacking for the reasons that I mentioned before, that Australian men are not too quick at expressing love. We want to be more cold and formal, and we sort of stand off, especially when we've got girls growing through their 16th, 17th, 18th year and so on. We say, here, hello, we've got another lady in the house. I've got a wife here, and now I've got one, two, maybe three more ladies to contend with, or to handle, or whatever. And a lot of men become rather cold-footed around this particular period. Now, it is a fact that as our teenage children grow up to manhood and womanhood, they really want to know that their father loves them. Now, it's not enough to say, oh, of course they can work that out for themselves, I pay all the bills. You'd probably moan all the time that you're doing it too. It's not enough. In council, I have found just so many married people who look back upon those days and they say, I did not know whether my father really loved me. Oh, he did all the right things, but he never showed me or affirmed it, never said it. And I wasn't really sure of myself. And I'm suffering today as a consequence. I dare say there are oodles of people in that bracket. I happened to walk into Standard Bookshop a couple of days ago and I saw a new book there by Germaine Greer. Don't all go rushing in there to buy it, will you? But on the cover it said, Daddy, I didn't even know you. Do you know there's a father who somehow fell down on his job and he might have even started the movement called Women's Lib? Mightn't he? Because that poor soul, Germaine Greer, you know, she had a father that she said, Daddy, I didn't even know you. You didn't even know me. And you know what her mother did? Germaine Greer tells us in another interview, which I read just not long ago, that her mother used to belt her just so much with a stick that she grew to be so afraid of her mother that every time she sat near her in the kitchen or around the table, she used to tremble with fear. She said, even when she reached adulthood, when she made visits home to her mother, she said she could not sit down at the table and dismiss the fear that was just wrenching at her gut. Dear friends, it's just so possible for parents to ruin their kids by withholding from them what they really need. They need love. I remember hearing a fellow in Los Angeles lecturing on this particular subject, and he said, I got a PhD today, mainly because I suppose I've just driven myself to prove what I can do to my father. He wouldn't be alone in that either. I wonder how many men have done what they've done to prove themselves to their dad. And you know, sometimes the father never gives approval anyway. This same fellow went on, he said, you know, while I've been a married man, he said, that sense of drive to please my father and to gain his approval hasn't died. He said, in my spare time, he's a psychologist, he said, in my spare time I make things out of wood, I make furniture and so on, I put them in the basement. And often when Dad and Mum come over to our place, I take them down there and sure enough, he'll tell me that there's something that's not quite right, or you could have done a better job over here. Next time you do it, do something else. He said, I don't take him down and show him down. I've given it up. Do you know, there are people in this world who are striving right now to please their father, and their father's dead. Pitiful, isn't it, really? They can't very much get his approval now, he's gone. The problem is he never ever gave it. And isn't it so easy for fathers never to be satisfied? Pull your socks up, son, quit, stop. Look, I've told you 1,000 times about that before. Now, when you do it next time, it's never quite right, is it? A lot of sons can't win. They can't win, because no matter what they do, there's always room for improvement, son. Fathers, I think we do our children a great service when we put our hand on their shoulder and we tell them that we're proud of them. We don't have to do it every week. I remember with my son, who had difficulties in just accepting himself and his abilities and so on, I put it on paper. I was living in another state at the time for 6 months, and he was leaving all his studies and everything and going out into the big wide world to work. And I thought, well, I don't want him to have any doubt about it. So I wrote him a letter and put it all down in paper, on paper, and told him that I loved him, told him I was proud of the things that he'd achieved, and a few other things of that nature. I believe we do them a service when we assure them that we're on their side and that we're not always confronting them with something, always correcting them about something, always showing them that they haven't really quite made it. I think there are many of us today whose lives in some ways have been spoiled because our fathers withheld that from us. The fourth thing I should say, D, this love is unconditional, unchanging, committed. Children who can count on it are secure. They are. Children who can count on it have got a security about them, which is a tremendous advantage. So it's a father's love that a father can give. Second thing, masculine authority. Now, we're saying that our sons and daughters need masculine authority in their lives. I'm not denying that there are some mums who, for one reason or another, have had to bring up children on their own who have never been able to do it. I wouldn't say that for a moment. I've known some single mums or widows that have brought up a family and done a fantastic job of it. But this, of course, is, shall I say, the exception. It's not God's plan. God's plan is that there be that masculine input. Discipline is not the sole responsibility of a mother. In fact, hers is only viable if backed by the father's authority. Many mothers find themselves betrayed by weak fathers who won't support them. Have you ever heard this sort of thing? Well, maybe you have. I go to a lot of homes. I live in or board in or stay in with all sorts of people because it's part of my work. It has been for many years. Have you ever heard this sort of thing? You know, mother says, deal with that little brat. He's just about to the point that I'm going to murder him. Dad says, oh, leave the kid alone. He's all right, come here. He's the peacemaker. You know, he's been busy all day and he can't be bothered dealing with the situation. What does that do? It just undermines what he's trying to tell his child. He's saying, you know, you respect your mother and you respect me. But he won't back her up. You know, if we were to sheet home the responsibility for the lack of discipline that there is in Christian families today, I think we're going to have to put it at the feet of the dads. Sorry and all that, but it just has to be that way. Many are not doing their job. B, it's not expressed in authoritarianism. Now, you know this type of person, don't you? The blustering, bully type of father. He won't produce the right product. The authoritarian father is not showing leadership, but he's covering up for his own personal inadequacies. And that's very often the case when a person blusters and they're angry and they're taking it out on everybody around them. They've got their own set of problems, unresolved, probably not even admitted to anybody. They're hardly even admitted to themselves. And yet they're taking out their anger upon the people that are around them. He's not showing leadership, but covering up for his own personal inadequacies. Now remember Ephesians 6:4 and Colossians 3:21. Now you will remember then when I mentioned to you that Paul says to fathers, don't provoke your children to anger. In other words, don't keep stirring, needling them. Get off their backs. That's what Paul is saying, if we could loosely paraphrase it. He said, don't be all the time antagonising your children so that they become angry. It means if you deal with them in fairness and justice And if you're reasonable with them and you treat your children as you would treat somebody else in the street, you know, sometimes we show more civility and more courtesy to the people up the road than we do to the people in our own house. No wonder teenagers don't stick around for long in many cases, because they get some civil answers to their questions when they're down at their friend's place. You know, authoritarianism is really this big swagger, isn't it? Throwing your weight around. But to have fatherly authority means that you've got a word that counts and that you've got justice in mind as you deal with your children. So let's keep away from unfair provocation. You know, some folk have the idea that when we talk discipline, all we're talking about is the punitive side. You know, we're going to punish you for this. We're going to welt you on the legs, you know, whatever. Or perhaps we're going to be nasty. We're going to be sarcastic towards you. That's discipline. Is it discipline? You know, you cut a person down verbally and you say, I'm disciplining you. That's not discipline. That's just finding an excuse to vent the nasty things that are inside your heart. You can speak firmly to your children without being negative and tearing them down. Our job is to construct, not to destroy, isn't it? And if we wanted to construct something in our children, the last thing we want to do is to hack away at their self-confidence. And you know, I think a generation or two back, that's just what parents did. Tremendous amount of it.
Little boy should be seen and not heard. When I want your opinion, I'll ask for it.
Now that was it, wasn't it? What's that do? That just simply says, you're not important, just pipe down. I don't want to hear what you've got to say. Friends, that's not the role for a parent. No, sir. Not the role for a father. See, guidelines for discipline have been decided together by spouses and then adhered to together. Too often men weaken on their word. Now again, as I say, I've been in many homes and people just do strike compromises all the time with their children. And once again, I have to be a little bit pointed here and say that I think that we have a whole generation of weak fathers around us. I don't want to generalise too much, but I do believe that I have seen something in epidemic proportions of weak fathers in our land. And I'm talking now about men whose word just doesn't count for anything. You know, they say something to their child, and as the old saying goes, the child does as it likes. Now, there's the kid, he's doing some annoying thing, and Dad says, Dad, don't do that, stop that noise. He says, oh, I only want to do it 100 times, and bang, 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 bang. And his father says, now look, you can't do it 100 times, you can do it 50, and that's all, okay? Oh, isn't he big, strong? He didn't want him to do it at all, but he finishes up giving him 50 chances at it. Oh dear, could I tell you some stories? I could tell you some stories. And sometimes in the homes of Christian leaders. Oh, no, I'm not going back in ancient history. I'm talking about things that have happened right up to date. Right up to date. You know, there they are, the Christian couple sitting at the table with their kids. And over on the side, there's the bookshelf, and I can see as I look along the top shelf, Dare to Discipline by Dr. James Dobson. Well, of course they've read it. Oh, yes, believe in disciplining the children. Of course we do. Well, one of them's on all fours, crawling along the table and shoving his hand into the Vegemite and then down into my drinking glass like that. And, you know, they do all kinds of things like this. Oh, now, come on, cut it out, Johnny, you know. We don't like people crawling across the table. But do you think Johnny cares? He doesn't care. He's got away with it all before, and he'll get away with it again. You know, they come to meetings, and they ruin a lot of the meetings that I speak at by squawking and fighting with their parents and wrestling down here in the front seat. This is why I like men's meetings. You don't bring them with you, do you? It's great. Yeah, it's good. I can even hear myself here today. Oh dear, would I like a dollar for every time my meetings have been ruined by the squawking and howling and fighting of fractious children? Boy, I'd be rich. I'd be able to run OAC for the next 10 years. I'm saying, men, that we should be people of our word. And that calls for firmness. Now, there is a big difference between waving the stick of a great ogre that's trying to frighten everybody and being a person who's firm, whose word actually counts for something. Now, I think we're verging on something here that's a little bit sensitive. And it's this. I think the Christian church is being overrun by wimps. You know, they're kind of lily-white fellas who are very domesticated and who don't have no in their vocabulary. And they're never going to make men of God. You know what I think is one of the reasons why many a man will not get the little character and give him a swift one across the backside and say, this is what I want you to do, now do it, and to make sure it actually happens. You know what I think it is? I've looked at it for a long time. I think that there's many a young man who thinks, if I act like that toward my child will not like me. And what I really badly want is for my child to like me and to love me. And so I'm going to be really careful not to do anything that's going to deprive him of his will. If he wants to throw a brick through the window, well, I can always mend the window, that's all right. And he becomes so soft, in the hope that his child is going to like him because he lets him have his way. Now, I have not seen that once, I have seen that hundreds of times. And I want to tell you, it is counterproductive. If you want a teenager, or perhaps he mightn't even reach his teenagers these days, but if you want somebody that's maybe even 12, 13, 14 years of age who turns around and thumbs his nose at you and treats you with contempt, well, that's a good way to start. When they're toddlers, let them have their way. And when they're 5 and 6 and 7 years of age and they put on a turn and they get their way with you and you give in or strike compromises with them, then you be assured that when they do get a little bit older, they'll disregard you because you've taught them to. They say, oh, yeah, if I just put on enough of an act, I'll get my way. I know how to twist my parents around the finger. And they do it. They do it again and again and again. But oh, the sad hearts, you know, they come so often after meetings and I have this happening all the time, I honestly do. Mothers, fathers saying, oh, I don't know what to do with my Fred. Oh, what to do with Freddy? Oh, he's really breaking our hearts. I said, well, how old Fred? Oh, he's 16. And away they go and they tell you all about what their boy's doing, the 16, 17, 18 years of age, and I just sort of die inside and I think, well, I don't know what I'm going to say to these people because they've left it all too late. Left it all too late. Sure, they might be just going through a phase and they're going to kick over the traces for a while and then get themselves straightened out. We hope that that kind of thing will happen. But in the meantime, there are many of them that are out there just living wild lives that are absolutely anything but what their parents wanted of them. And the parents perhaps didn't realise at the time that when they were giving in to them as toddlers, they were paving the way for this thing to happen. They really were. Now, when I use this word, I think I choose it carefully. Sons treat weak fathers with contempt. Contempt. Now, I don't know about you, but that's one of the things I would really not enjoy. To be treated with contempt by my son. Would you enjoy it? If you're manly and you mean what you say, even if you're wrong, in the long run they'll respect you. They'll say, well, my old man at least knew what he wanted and he didn't vacillate. He wasn't like a piece of jelly. You push him on one side and he moves, and you go around the other side and you push him on that side and he moves again. You know the kind of father that really is a good father? He's a father that's like a big solid old tree trunk or something like that, or not the lemon tree, but there he is. He's got his roots well down, and when the kids bump into him they realise they've bumped. You know, But there's something dependable about that kind of man, isn't there? And not only the wife, but the kids and everybody else, they say, well, at least we know where Dad is. He's not going to be in one place today and a different place tomorrow. That's where he is. He's anchored, and I can depend on him. Important. You know, we have people today that are trying to blur the distinctions of masculinity and femininity. We've got some who want to rid our vocabulary of those words entirely. They want to say that, you know, masculinity is only something that's been raised up by society and all of its pressures over the years. It's only a ghost that, you know, has been formed by society. And the same thing with femininity. And so they're saying, be gone to both of those concepts. You've heard them, haven't you? That's really radical feminism. They're saying, we don't want anything to do with that kind of thing. Well, here I greatly disagree with them. Because I believe that masculinity, femininity, came from the hand of the Creator. Now, we need to be careful to see what it is we're talking about. But I have a feeling that there are many who need a bit of masculinity in our churches today. And I've been tempted, didn't talk to Bob about this, but you know, to get a whole lot of syringes for a men's seminar with male hormones in them and, you know, whack a few of them home. Because there are some of them, you know, there are some guys in our churches today that could do with an injection. Yeah. Probably against the law, I think, Bob, isn't it? Yeah, we'd have some difficulties with that. Let me ask you this question. You fire the answers back at me. What appeals to you as manliness? We get quite a few words here. Manliness. What do you think of when you think of manliness? Keeping your word, John says down the front here. Decisive. Keep your word. Something else. Sorry? Strength, right. Manliness means strength, and it's not just muscle strength, is it? It's moral strength as well. Integrity, good word, coupled with honesty. Dependable, yes, right. Stable, stability, fair enough, great. Loving, good. Wise? Yes, wise. Some more? No. I was just going to mention the word courage. We need that too. Something more? Yes, responsible. Yeah, responsible. You've got to have a pair of shoulders to be a man. You can't be round shouldered because the burdens slip off. Something else? Yeah, determination. I like that one. It really speaks of endurance and the ability to stick at the task and so on. That's good. Something else? I'll just read a few words I jotted down here. Yes, we've got courage, strength, determination. There you go. It all came from you. Willingness to work. Willingness to protect and provide. To put up with things without whimpering. To be decisive. Not to be easily led. Now, I think many a writer has pointed out that that has been a little weakness in the opposite sex. Please don't say anything to them when you get home, but they have been inclined to be easily led, right? That's right. That's why you married them. And a man is to be reliable. Isn't that it? Reliable. That's what I was saying about that tree trunk. Hey, how about this? How about this for manliness? One word. Five letters. J-E-S-U-S. Want to know what manliness is all about? Look here into the word. Have a look at the portraits of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John and you'll see the man. Won't you? The man. Was he weak and vacillating? You know, they tried to portray him that way in Jesus Christ Superstar, but all they did was created a non-being, somebody that wasn't here. Was the Lord Jesus easily led by other people?
No. Did he have a determination? Did he set his face, as it were, as a flint, to go to Jerusalem? Did he put up with the sufferings? Amen. Did he speak the truth on all occasions and didn't equivocate? Yes. Everything that you could call a manly attribute is seen in him. So men, we don't have to look any further for an example, because he is the example. He's our model. And it would be good, I think, for all of us to look at him as our example. At the bottom of our page, page 10, it says manly example. Boys will imitate their fathers for good or ill. Not in all things, but always in some things. And this calls for attention to A, the way we treat their mother. If we treat our mother as a good chauvinist would, then our boys are probably going to learn from us and perhaps will do it themselves. In fact, you will find in a given home that if father mouths off sometimes in front of the children at his wife, that you'll find some of these growing sons will do the same. You know, dad comes in, why is my tea on the table? And large son sometimes comes in, why is my tea on the table? Where did he learn that from? He learned it from dad, didn't he? And then how we live morally and ethically, our actions will speak louder than our words. Our kids are always observing us, aren't they? And what they see in us in the moral and ethical area is not going to be overlooked. They're going to see it. Number three, or C, now our attitude to work, neighbours, in-laws, pastors, and our whole sphere of relationships is in their view and will have influence. Mind you, much of it is just simply going to come out in the way we talk, isn't it? You heard about roast preacher on Sundays when come home after having heard the message and we sit around the table and tell everybody what was wrong with it. You know, in all kinds of ways we can be doing this. We can run down the person next door, we can talk about our boss behind his back, and all of those comments, some of them very, very negative about other people, criticisms that tear other people down and so on. Our family is privy to this. They very often are all ears, and it's going to influence them. As it's been said, the child who lives with criticism learns to condemn. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, we don't point out wrong things to them when we see them. There are times when we must do that. We don't just simply go along with everything we see and hear. Of course we need to point out that which is wrong. But we need to be very careful that we're not putting other people down for the sake of putting them down, because all we'll do is teach our children to do the same. D, if we want to see our children go on for Christ, we must live as Christians in the home with strong convictions backed by holy living. Double standards are disastrous. A man is to be a respected priest in his family, not a hypocrite held in contempt. Our family has the habit, and particularly years ago had the habit, of going up to the Flinders Ranges every year for our holidays. One of the things that my son used to demand almost was, Dad, we've got to get up early in the morning and go for a walk. So the morning walk became an established kind of institution. And so every morning he and I were up walking on those mountain tops and seeing all the kangaroos and the other kind of hops too, you know, that grow up there, and seeing the birds and the water and the sun rising and all the rest of it, while his mum and his sisters were back there in their sleeping bags, you know, having a nice time. And I found that when he was just a lad, he always had the habit of getting behind me. I'd say, hey, Jeff, come up this way. Walk with me. And he'd walk with me for a little while. And he'd drop back again. And he was only a little boy, but he just loved to walk behind me. And on one occasion I heard him say, I'm walking in your footsteps, Dad. He was putting his feet where I put mine. It really made me think. I thought, that's what all sons are doing to a measure. They're seeing where their father puts his foot and they put theirs in the same place. Really means you've got to be careful what you do and where you go, doesn't it? Well, he walks in front of me now. Number four.
And I have to say, oh son, slow down. Where's the fire? And this Robert over here, he's a culprit too. Robert Nathan, my goodness, don't ever go bushwalking with him. He's got long legs. And his brother Peter, goodness me, do they ever stride it out? I usually meet them when they're coming back home. We've had some fun. But then the fourth thing that a father can give is godly guidance. The greatest teacher in the life of the child is a parent. Our input will be never forgotten. Its effect will never be entirely shaken off. A child might as well run away from its own shadow as to try to escape the influence of father's genes and father's guidance. You know, in the educational world today, there are many people who fight against this principle, and they say, oh, kids, you know, be your own person. Cut yourself off from your parental influence. Just think that they're old fogies and realise that they're not up with the things that you're up with today. And establish your own world and sing out for your own rights and fight for this cause and that cause. And that's been going on in educational circles for quite some years. I'm not saying it's all of them, but there's certainly that element there. I think, again, they're right out of it. They've missed the boat, missed the point. Just as God put masculinity and femininity into the people that he created, he also gave the task of one generation to teach the one that followed it. And C.S. Lewis refers to this as old birds teaching young birds to fly. Now I wonder if these modern thinking, trendy people standing on the side of the hill watching the birds learning to fly would be thinking, my goodness, that old bird there, you know, imposing its way of flying upon those young birds there. I mean, it's so, why shouldn't a bird find its own way to fly? It doesn't have to flap its wings just because its old man flapped its wings. Goodness me, let's throw stones at it. There's a right way and a wrong way about a lot of things, isn't there? Don't you think? There's a right way and a wrong way to fly. And I think that we can say a lot of things to our kids that are really going to help them to get on in this world, and that's our privilege to be able to do so. The areas of teaching will be why we're in this world, discussion of the big questions of philosophy and theology. And I've suggested here the right time and place, of course. I mean, if they've got 3 minutes to finish their toast and catch the bus to go to work, please don't start on Aristotle. You won't get very far. You have to really wait your moment. In fact, kids don't like lectures, do they? But it's great when you're away and you're looking into the fire like we used to do up in the Flinders Ranges. We talked about all the subjects under the sun or under the stars. And it was great because, you know, you pick the right moment and they're open for it and they want to know all sorts of answers to the big questions of life. And then we teach them what is valuable. Teaching to appreciate what ought to be appreciated. That was actually the definition of education that Plato gave. And I endorse it. I think it's great, don't you? Teaching to appreciate what ought to be appreciated. There are some things that ought to be appreciated in this world, and there are others that ought not to be. So what we're doing is forming a value system. And if parents don't have input into their child's value system, let me tell you, somebody else will. And they won't always be the right people, will they? How to understand oneself. Now this of course was a taboo subject when I was being brought up. Nobody could tell me. But today we've got a lot of information about temperament, about strength of character or weaknesses, how to gain and keep a positive self-image. I believe these things are very, very significant. Now here a father has got significant effect upon this self-view. You find a person who is just so shy and so withdrawn and can do nothing in front of people, and very often you'll find they've got a father who's as hard as nails. That's right. I met a married woman in a northern suburb some time ago, and somebody introduced me to her. She was just sitting down on the couch in the lounge room. She had her hands like this, just wringing them together. She couldn't look up at me. Her eyes were up here at some sort of weird angle, and she said, "Hello." And as I talked with her, she was just so totally withdrawn and embarrassed and all the rest of it. And yet, an intelligent, educated person. She was. She was. And the problem in that case might have been a father originally, but in this case it was a husband. And I found out the story that every time he saw her, he just had a mouthful of abuse and negative comment for her that just drove her further and further into the ground. Not good. Skills for living. The book of Proverbs was written or compiled for a son or sons.
Its contents are old but never out of date. Oh boy, there's so much there in the book of Proverbs. You can just keep on going through it and through it and through it, and you'll never assimilate it all. Attitudes to one's occupation, family relationships, neighbour relationships, to God and to nature are all capable of being formed by heeding this book. So don't forget the book of Proverbs. Okay, would you like just to quietly to yourself read those two little extracts? You can run your eyes over those fairly quickly. But we will press on, folks. There are many things which fathers will learn by being fathers. A man who talks and doesn't listen will fail as a father. True? You've got to listen. A man who assumes he knows it all will never learn and grow, and furthermore, if he knows it all, he'll alienate his adult children. True? You know, why would kids come home, sit at the table and listen to Dad pouring out all his ignorance? You know, so very often one of the kids has got an MA or an MSc or something in a particular subject, and Dad starts on the subject and tells the whole family all he knows about it. It isn't much, but he takes a long while to do it. A man who fails to keep open channels of communication with his children will live with regret. I suggest keep the channels open no matter how extenuating the circumstances. Don't cut them off. Cut your children off and you've taken away the only means whereby you can touch them and get near them. Okay, God is dealing with fathers as well as children. How true, eh? Here's another book by Gordon MacDonald called The Effective Father. And there's a little poem there, some lines. How he ruthlessly perfects whom he royally elects. How he hammers him and hurts him, and with every blow converts him into trial shapes of clay which only God can understand. Being a leader in a marriage and a family is not only for the sake of the wife and children, it's for the development of the man and the increase of his understanding of the fatherhood of God. Now here's another little extract from Elizabeth Elliot, who talks a lot of sense. A leader is a man who does not groan under burdens, but who takes them as a matter of course, allows them, tolerates them, and with a dash of humour. He knows how to keep his mouth shut about his difficulties and how to live a day at a time, doing quietly what needs to be done at the moment. People will follow that sort of man. Sounds daunting, doesn't it? But being a leader is a high calling. And dear friends, if you do feel that a lot has been sort of unloaded onto you today, just remember again the line at the bottom that says, our sufficiency is of God. And remember that it's a high and a holy calling. Why not go for it? Because there are tremendous rewards. Let's just try this self-check. I have underlined words which I think should describe the man who leads his home. He will need to be considerate and courteous to those around him, solid in his convictions, responsible under God, exemplary in his conduct. He will be decisive when called upon, tough when necessary, but tender in his heart. His life will be disciplined and he will be growing more like the Lord. In this, he becomes more self-forgetful, more humble, but ever alert to what is happening to the people in his home. At every opportunity, he is complimentary and appreciative of other people's work and things, being encouraging about the efforts made by his loved ones. Talking with an open heart, rather than silent as a closed book, he is a listening ear for those who want his attention for a while. As a person who is fun to live with, he will be humorous and able to take a joke on himself.